Okay, in honor of Tu Bishvat, which this week is dedicated to, I'm going to remind you that there is a dinner this Friday night, 6 p.m. Tu Bishvat dinner, with all kinds of Tu Bishvat delicacies. Okay, so there are four parts to this presentation. Okay, and they will all involve trees of some sort. The first part will, of course, begin with the first reference to a tree in the Tanakh, which is in the Garden of Eden, correct? So the point of the Garden of Eden is that God created a perfect place for us. We didn't have any worry about parnasa, about support and our daily materialistic needs. We didn't have any worry about, ostensibly, about health issues. There were very ferocious animals walking right in our midst, right? Ostensibly, we didn't have any Yetzer Hara issues, right? And we didn't have any fears. I'm just looking at the idyllic existence that we were put here on earth. We didn't have Yetzer Hara problems, right? We didn't have a shidduch problem that was set up, right? So whatever issues we may have today, we didn't have in the garden. But the human being, as Socrates points out often in his dialogues, must have some kind of cheshbon. There must be some analysis of what my life is. We're not here to just sit down and sip lemonade on a lounge chair and enjoy life unimpeded by our daily existential problems, in many of which I just mentioned. Where's my next meal coming from? Where is my, might I have a health problem coming up? So the life has to be examined. We were not just put into the ark just to have a good time. We were put there la'avda u'lashamra, which means we were put into the garden to guard it and to work it. La'avda, there was some avoda. The Garden of Eden was not without its workings, right? We can tell perhaps from some of the curses we got upon leaving the garden, right? Of that this is from now on, you're going to have to till the soil and it will produce thorns for you. Okay, before the hand, we would till the soil and produce produce, right? That was more predictable and more reliable, right? So the first point about the Garden of Eden is that we may have a misconception about what our role, our perfect role should have been. I will tell you that you will find, I'm not going to pursue it here, but you will find one prophecy in Sefer Yeshayahu that tries to analyze what our place in existence was meant to be, what was ruined because of what went wrong in the garden. Yeshayahu presents it as an inevitability. We were not going to stay in the garden ad infinitum because it was inevitable, just as much as your child once rebelled, that we were going to rebel.
Bechira was there.
Bechira was certainly there. You see, the very different opinions between Christianity and Judaism on these issues, because Christians, Islam has nothing to say about this. Islam doesn't have that story, but Christianity does. They revere our what they call the Old Testament. So there's very different opinions over what man's sinful nature, rebellious nature was. I'll tell you this, that I don't want to veer too far off. I want you to think while I'm talking, what prophecy am I talking about in Yeshayahu? But there is a very interesting discussion in the Talmud, in Maseches Sanhedrin, Daf Lamed Zayin, over the first day of Adam and Eve in the garden. According to our tradition, they sinned on their first day. And it goes hour by hour. It's a 10-hour day. goes hour by hour what they did in their first day in the Garden of Eden. And look, you know, who has time to look through all these things? But there is a 9th century church father's work called Elucidarium. It's written in Latin, and it is modeled after and is modeled similarly to the Kuzari. It's a teacher fielding questions from a very inquisitive student, and one of the student's questions is to his teacher, what happened to Adam and Eve on their first day in the garden? Without quoting Maseches Sanhedrin, this church father in the 9th century has a tradition. He says, we have a tradition that these are the 10 things Adam and Eve did in their first day in the garden. And lo and behold, it's, of course, it doesn't quote Sanhedrin, but he had the same tradition, because he lists all the same 10 things that Adam and Eve did on the same day as what appears in the Gemara. But he switches one of them. In the Gemara, in the 7th hour, it says, Adam and Eve went to bed 2 and came out 3, that they had a child. And then it says that they sinned in the garden. In Elucidarium's version, it could be no children without the sin, because they only sinned because they violated the, you know, the directive in the garden. Anyway, they switched the 7th and the 8th hour, right, between the sin and the... Like, now, the fact, though, is that chapter 3 is the garden story, and chapter 4 is the birth of Cain and Hevel. In fact, in the Bible, the birth of Cain and Hevel does take place after the sin in the garden.
Yeah.
All right, but Rashi points out that that the birth of Cain and Hevel starts off with a very unusual grammatical form. The Adam Yoda es Chava Ishto. Biblical Hebrew should have been Vayeda Adam es Chava Ishto. You have to hear the Hebrew. The Hebrew, it's very unusual form. The Adam Yoda es Chava Ishto. It's used a few other times in Bereshis, like Hashem Pokad es Sarah instead of Vayivkod Hashem es Sarah. There too, Rashi says something about that. So what Rashi says is that Cain and Hevel or at least Cain was conceived before the sin and born after the sin. It all happened so quickly. Right? So, be that as it may, the only thing I want to bring out is that, as Socrates mentioned, as I just said, we're not here to just sit in a lounge chair and sip lemonade and enjoy the sun. We're here to do work. We're here to perfect ourselves. The real sin, as I would like to present it to you in the Garden of Eden, is that by eating from the tree, Adam and Eve wanted to attain that work, that avda and shamra, by just taking a shortcut, by just eating from the tree. And that, whatever that represents. Now, what does this have to do with Tu B'Shvat? Is that I submit to you, and this is why Yeshayahu, who has it's not a full chapter, but it's certainly the beginning of the chapter, it's a very famous prophecy. Many schools make the students memorize this prophecy. And it is also a prophecy analyzing what is the human being here to do on earth. How, are we different than the penguin or the crab or the insect? What are we? Are we just more evolved? What are we here for? Obviously, we're in God's image, so there's something special for us. And we must analyze what we're here for. Nothing else on the planet needs to do that. But we have to. So there's a cheshbon. We must be commanded. If there is life on other planets, and so what if there is? If there is life that's also in God's image, and I don't mean by the way we look, I mean by the way we have a soul and can communicate, that if we are in the image of God, we must be commanded. It must be things that are expected. We're judged. There are expectations of us. Chazal tell us that the pasuk that God commanded Adam about not eating from the tree, that God commanded 6 things in that verse. And that's why he holds Cain responsible. Cain thinks, God, well, so I killed him. Okay, he's not moving. I didn't know I killed him. I certainly wanted to rip him into pieces. So it says, called blood was spilled when he killed him. So, according to the Kli Yakar, Cain says to God, You want to know about my brother? I know you know it. You know everything, God. I'm not hiding from you. But my question to you is, Lo yadati hashomer achi anochi. It's a manipulation of the heha, the chataf patach under the hay. Right? Because it's Lo yadati. I don't know where he is. Hashomer achi anochi. Am I my brother's keeper? Right? But the Kli Yakar manipulates this to say, Lo yadati hashomer achi anochi. You never told. Where did you ever tell me? No, I shouldn't do what I just did to him. I'm not responsible. Right? I hold you. And God's answer to Cain is, yes, you are. I hold you naturally responsible to know that what you did to your brother is wrong and you're going to be punished for it. I'm judging you. As God judges Adam. Right? So, here it is. I'll let the cat out of the bag now. The prophecy in Yeshayahu is chapter 5. Right? And it is consistent with our story in Bereishis, in that the thing that God uses to test man, to teach man that we are, I have expectations of you. Turn to page 960. The thing that I test you with, the expectation I have of you, is tied to a tree. Anybody know what prophecy I'm talking about yet in Yeshayahu? Ashira nali didi shirat shirat dodi lekarmel. Okay, I want to sing a song about it's good Shabbos Shira this week. It's a chumash. You need a tanach.
Oh.
Here, here's a tanach right here. Pass that down. Okay, so I'm singing a song to my vineyard. Right now, the vineyard is something planted by a man of the earth, right? And he, in Pasuk Bet, it talks about all the things that this farmer put into the vineyard. And I don't know if any of there are any vintners here. I did everything I needed to do. Vayazkeyu, vayisakleyu, vayiteyu sorek, vayivin migdol besocho, vagam yekev chotsevbo. It describes the thing, just a few of the things that the Bible is not in that, in page 960, chapter 5. 960, chapter 5. The Bible is not in the habit of teaching us details about how to grow a good vineyard. Right? It just gives us a few minor points. Right? And I even put a yekev. Yekev is a very important thing to have in the vineyard itself, so you can just make the wine right there on the spot. Okay? So, when I was in Israel last week, we toured some places in the Gush. We saw an ancient Yekev, mamash from 2,500 years ago. You could see all the stones and the little drains for the wine to drain down to the after. And you see the place where they would step on the grapes on the top. And okay, all right. So he says, I even put a Yekev right in there. Vayikav laso sanavim, and I was hoping to that it should make grapes, vayas beushim, and instead it just made raisins. Can't make wine out of that. Right? Vatoy Yoshev Yerushalayim v'ish Yehuda, shiftu na beinu uvein karmi. Whose fault is it that the wine didn't come out good? In other words, God's saying, whose fault is it that, man, you're messing up so much? It's my fault, right? Because I created you with free will. Yeah? So I gave you free will, I gave you Eitzahara. Remember what the Gemara says, the Yetzirah is like a tavlin, it's like a spice. It makes life spicy, right? Our evil inclination. But we have a Torah that helps us to control that spice. Simple. When do you have to start controlling that? 2 years old. Maybe three. Right? 3 years old. The child wants ice cream. And we all know, anyone who's been involved with any child knows that their tantrum will continue as long as they think the tantrum will work for them. As soon as they know that the tantrum will not get me anything, even a two-year-old understands, tantrum over. Question is, what are the parents willing to negotiate about? Depends where you are. If you're in the middle of a crowded, you're online at the supermarket and the kid is kicking and screaming, you may have to give in there and then come down hard at home. Right, but no matter how much they're kicking and screaming, let's say at the supermarket, I must have that cereal. You can't tell them you can't have that cereal because it's packed with artery clogging saturated fat, or because it is too much cholesterol or too much sugar in it. You're going to bounce off the walls all day if you have this cereal for breakfast. You can't tell them that. A 3-year-old can't process that. But you can tell them.
No.
No, because
it's not kosher.
It's not kosher. 3-year-old, under the proper circumstance, can process that. Mm-hmm. I know. I've said with my own kids, my grandchildren. They want something, you can't have it. Why not? Because you're fleishigs and that's dairy.
Uh-huh.
A 3-year-old understands that. You can't have that ice cream. They'll kick and scream like crazy that they want to have that ice cream. And they're old enough to know that if you tell them a good reason that they can process why they can't have that ice cream, that they know is true and real, that will work. Right? Now, what kills that is hypocrisy. If you told him at 3 years old that you can't have the ice cream because you're fleishigs, and then they see their parent, they'll remember for the rest of their lives what fleishigs is. Of course, they're living with it all the time. If they see their parent 2 hours after having a chicken, and he said, "Oh, well, that was just chicken. Don't worry." So that's it. Forget it. You can throw out years and years of education with one or two acts of hypocrisy, where the parents aren't willing to do what they're expecting of their children. I have a harsh opinion on this. It's not only what you teach them at home; it's what you teach them in the school. If you send your kids to a school where there's a washing cup in the lunchroom. And they're expected to wash before they go in to have their meal, right? Even if it's not done, it's mostly kept in the breach, but it's expected, it's there, right? So when the kids come home and see, my parents are never doing that, we don't even own a washing cup. Forget it. You're expecting me to do something at school that we're not doing at home. Goodbye. But you know the real problem is that most parents don't care. At least in the talking about a particular school where I teach, but most of the parents, they don't care. Why am I sending them to a school like this? So they'll be with other Jewish kids and hopefully marry a Jew. But for many, it stops at that, right? So when God puts them in the garden and says, I have expectations of you, and I expect that if I have to make more expectations, that you'll follow those as well. You can't tell a 3-year-old everything that you expect of them. There's a few things I expect of you. We only eat kosher food in this house, right? We keep Shabbos in this house, right? Right? You give a 3-year-old boy a pair of tzitzis, but he sees that his father doesn't wear tzitzis. Forget it. It's not going anywhere. That kid's going to pull off his tzitzis the first chance he gets. Right? Goes to a mitzvah, he gets a pair of tefillin, and he puts on. He's expected to come into minyan in school every day and wear tefillin, and his father's not wearing tefillin. It's not going to work. All right? Okay. So what does this have to do with the vineyard? 1 second. Is that the vineyard has expectations. What do you plant a vineyard for? To get wine. Or to get grapes. All right? And God bemoans the fact that the vineyard I planted, and who's a better vintner than I am? Right? Who can make a better vineyard than God? But you know what? This is a famous question that educators are trying to work out with their parent body. What can you do to make sure your kids don't do drugs and don't engage in dangerous behavior? You know what the answer to that question is? Nothing. There's nothing a parent can do to assure that the child will not do drugs. It's only the child can do something to assure that the child won't do drugs. Your child is an arrow in the hands of the archer. As soon as they let go, them letting go doesn't mean they get their own apartment or get married. Letting go is when they go on the school bus to kindergarten. Right? That's already letting go, because the kid is going to now talk to other kids on the bus, and who knows what they're getting? Who knows what the parents of those other kids are allowing them to engage in? Right? So that's it. They're out there now. Fickle winds will keep that arrow from hitting its target. Right? That's why the Gemara in Moed Katan says, Chayim is only b'ni toli b'mazel. How the kids come out needs mazel. by all means, do everything you can to make sure that the mazel works in your direction. Right? The people who rely on mazel alone are usually the most unlucky people. Right? You don't expect luck. You can prepare for luck. Right? Okay. So Yeshayahu's picture of the question, this is how Sadi Gaon understands chapter 5 of Yeshayahu, is that it's a question of mankind, not just Yisrael, not just Bnei Yisrael. Bnei Yisrael is God's messenger to get his word out to all of mankind. But mankind, what are you doing? Right? You know, on every Friday I let my students have 11th grade honor students in high school. And I let them ask questions on Fridays. Any question you have on anything. Right? So sometimes I ask them to write down certain thoughts, and I said, okay, everybody, you have a 2-sentence letter to write to God. What are you going to write? Right? So, and then we read the answers, and we try to guess who said, in the class, said which answer. So one kid wrote, "Dear God, I'm sorry we are so profoundly messing up your world." He wrote it with a little more color than that, but okay. So I don't know. People will you know, put a lot of blame at God, you know. Right? But he's saying that there are worms and there are caterpillars that are eating away at the leaves, eating away at the fruit. What's going on here? I gave you a garden, and look what's happening to it. So, and that's all I'm going to do with chapter 5 of Yeshayahu. But be aware that there's a prophet in Tanakh that talks about what we were given, a vineyard with all this work done to it, and what it has come to, what it has turned to. And the place to start is with ourselves. Don't think about going to Washington and hold up a placard and going to, you know, go to Jerusalem. Start with ourselves, and that's a good step. It's just a little anthropopathic that God says, why did I hope, why was I so silly to think I'm going to get a good bottle of wine out of this vineyard, and all look what I'm getting. Madu kivisi laso sanavim vayaspi ushim. And all I'm getting are rotten raisins. Right? Really, God, you're God. I mean, guys in California put all the work into vineyards and they get good wine. Why not, you know? I'm now going back to moving away from the metaphor, but God is saying, look, I know what it is. I gave you free will. Free will made those things. It's not me. You want to go back against the rules and put yourselves in what Brave New World, remember, where everyone is programmed to be something. No one has a free will. No. Right? Okay. So that's the first thing, is that the Garden of Eden is tied to a tree. God's question of whether this is the best of all possible worlds is also tied to a tree. And that leads to famous pasuk. Let's turn now back to a pasuk in the Torah. I'm in Parsha Shoftim. That puts me on page 474. Make that 476. 476. Okay, verse 19. Ki tatsur el ir, when you are laying siege on a city, yomim rabim li lachem aleha, many days to fight against it, the tafsa, in order to capture it, lo tashchis es etza lindoach alav garzen. Do not put your axe to any of the trees. Trees are for you to eat from, not to cut down. Now, aren't we allowed to cut down trees?
For eating.
Trees that don't produce fruit. Fruit trees, we shouldn't. Okay? Alright. Ki adam eitz ha-sadeh lavo mipanecha b'matzor. So, did I read that properly the last time? Right? So usually this work that we're looking at now, this is the Schottenstein Tanakh. So usually they translate psukim like Rashi. However Rashi interprets the pasuk, they'll translate it. So Rashi understands this to be a question. Right? Don't cut down the trees. You eat from trees. Don't cut down trees that feed you. And don't, by all means, do not engage in scorched earth policies, which many nations have done in war, right? Where they burn the earth that they either that they retreat from or the like. Is the tree a human being, a person that can defend himself? No. The poor tree is a sitting duck. In one of the, maybe you've seen or you've read it, in one of the, what's the name of the book? It's all escaping me now because I made it into movies.
The Giving Tree.
No, that's
you mean the book?
The Hobbit and what's it called? With the ring, you know, they had to destroy the ring. What's it called?
Tolkien.
Yeah, Lord of the Rings. Yeah. So in one of the episodes, I think the first one, they were about to destroy the whole Middle Earth or whatever it is, until they went against the trees. When they remember, it was the trees that the trees came to life because they were attacking the trees. They were cutting down trees, so trees came to life and defended themselves, and then carried the humans a long distance in order to win the next battle. But everything in the Lord of the Rings has been understood to be some kind of metaphor about the fight of good against the fight of evil, which really was co-opted by Harry Potter and became much more popular. But you see a lot of the common themes between the two series. But this is what it is that what Rashi says this means is that how can you do this to a tree? The tree gives you so much, and it can't even defend itself. Right? The Rashi couldn't even know the half of it, how much trees are giving us. Right? So, but be careful, because this is limited to fruit trees, right? Other non-bearing fruit trees can be cut down, and they also do good things for us. So that's number two. Okay. Yes.
Just sometimes when you get an overview of something, it just shocks you when it's just like a cold water in your face. The major philosophies that came out of the modern age, of Romanticism and existentialism, look at the tree and nature as being self-sufficient, and that we are contingent because we have free will. And they long for the lack of anguish of the choice that nature has, because it is. It doesn't question its own existence. And both Victor Hugo in the Sadness of Olympia, which is the gods themselves, and Sartre in No Exit, or one of his major, like, existent being and nothing, whatever, looks at a tree, envies it, says, "You don't have my problems. I wish I was you." And it's the battle of human beings against nature. Nature ruling us. Here, God is ruling nature. So all of a sudden, the tree becomes inevitable that you shouldn't damage because it gives you tree. And Silverstein comes out with his book, The Giving Tree. This is very Hamish. It's against the entirety of civilization.
I'll tell you that the anti-Semite in the 19th century used this back to nature kind of thing as a linchpin of anti-Semitism, because the Jew was building factories. The Jew was building was getting into very much mercantile activity in the Industrial Revolution. The Jew had that genius to make investments and not just
the only ones.
But the Jew was Richard Wagner and some of his operas, to go back to that, in a time of innocence and with
that's the people they were serving, who were controlling
the
whole
Jews were
the Jews
really,
weren't allowed in.
The Jews were really took the brunt of this, and you're right, it wasn't only the Jew doing this, that's for sure. But the Jew was and then when the so the Jew was punished for being the capitalist, and then the Jew was punished for being the communist. So it was all
wrong.
It was as if though it was a cabal that the Jewish capitalist is going to deliver the worker to the Jewish communist and then it will take over the world. So it was of course this did have to do with the whole
return to nature. Soul cycle is basically just getting your chemicals, your endorphins, and whatever goes on. So, in a communal group to avoid having to come to a shul and pay dues.
I think what's happening here is that the more modern, last 20 years or so, approach towards the observance of Tu Bishvat, which is really what we're moving to now, has attempted to, even under a Jewish milieu, and under Jewish auspices, if you will, to get back to this kind of nature, which is well represented in the Talmud and Midrashim about the importance of the environment and the prohibition against wanton waste or any waste. Mm. Right? When we hear the word baltashchis, we usually think of extra peas on the plate that you're going to throw in the garbage rather than eat. Right? Baltashchis, what are you wasting food, you know? So baltashchis refers to any kind of waste. You know, I sometimes the kids make fun of me because I use a tea bag and I say, why should I throw the tea bag out? There's still tea in there. I'll have it for my next cup. Right? But that's me, that's baltashchis. You know, it's like, look, I remember you 25 years ago, if you had a car in the city, they'd break your window and cause you $500 damage to get at a $15 radio that's in your console. So.
You should try the door first.
You know, I know people used to leave the door open because of that.
Oh, yeah.
Take it.
Door open.
Door open.
Yeah. Nothing in car.
No, there used to be nothing in car. We said, please, help yourself, whatever you see.
But, Rabbi, what this challenge.
Don't break my window.
This challenges the whole question of human agency and responsibility, which many other religions have picked up on, most singularly Christianity picked up on. That's a pagan element of Christianity where you're going to get vicarious salvation. Somebody once asked a French romantic, who was a horrible man, borrowed money from friends and then used it to romance their wives, the wives of the people, whatever, did absinthe, whatever, and said, how can you do this? How can you live like? Have you no fear of God? So he says, famously, I have to say it in French, Dieu me pardonnera, God will forgive me, c'est son métier. That's his purpose of existence. In other words, I'm a poor, the original sin that we're talking about is not a tendency towards, it's you're damned, you're stuck, that's it.
That's great, I can do what I want,
and then I'll be saved later. So then we have the tshuva of a little of the
thing. It infantilizes.
Human beings, exactly.
So infantilizes human beings.
And that's the real basis, to me it's one of the major bases of anti-Semitism.
Okay. Yes, yes.
Make people feel bad about themselves instead of
making
them feel good.
All right, so now let's turn the corner and move to a different area. And I would like you to be aware, I mean, this is a little late. Tu Bishvat is an early Tu Bishvat this year. It'll be even earlier next year. Wait till you get to next year. Tu Bishvat will be in the beginning of January next year, because it's before a leap year. But I'd like you to turn, please, with me to Yirmiyahu chapter 10, which is on page 1094. Page 1094. This is one verse after the end of the Haftarah of Tisha B'Av. So it's a very, very bad, very morose part of Sefer Yirmiyahu. And he's preparing the people for the inevitable exile. You will be in Babylonia. Many of you, millions of you. You will be in Babylonia. And I have to tell you to prepare. That's why chapter 10 of Yirmiyahu is the only chapter in all of Nevi'im that has a full verse in Aramaic. Because he's talking to them in the language they'll be speaking in Babylon. Okay? All right, so we're looking at page 1094. And he tells them what to expect when they get to Babylon. Right? And you must protect yourself from this type of behavior because this is what you're going to see there. It's very different than what you got used to in Israel. Okay, and here's what it is. Shimu et ha-davar asher diber Hashem aleichem beit Yisrael. Listen to this word I'm telling you, house of Israel. Ko amar Hashem, thus says the Lord, el derech ha-goyim al tilmadu. Do not learn from the ways of the nations. U'me'otot ha-shamayim al techatu. And from the heavenly signs, do not be fearful. Who would be fearful of heavenly signs?
those who believe in the stars.
The zodiac, the horoscope. You know, some people don't. They say Winston Churchill didn't leave his house until he read his horoscope for that day. You know, the person prosecuting World War II for the world is worried about his horoscope, right? Okay. So don't, because Babylon was the capital of the world at that time. That's what, you know, the Gemara refers to fortune tellers as Chaldeans, as, you know, as Kastim, and right? The Babylonians were the chief, just like the Egyptians were in the time that we left Egypt.
What was the capital of Babylon in those days? The center of its culture.
Shinar, they're interchangeable with Kastim. At the time of maybe over some later
that's
time.
That's in Zmiras of Basra.
That's right, yes. But there are two Basras, one in Edom and one in Babel. So, yeah. The one we're saying in Zmiras is the one in Edom. Okay, so, Kichukos ha'amim hevel hu. What they fear, the things that they worry about, their customs are they're nonsense, they're foolish. Ki eats mi ya'ar kroso. They take a tree from the forest. Maseye de charosh b'matzad, and they remove it from the ground, and then they take it and they make carpentry with it, and they take it to their house. B'kesef uvazav yapehu, and they decorate it with gold and silver streams. B'masmeros uvmakavos yichazkum. And they take nails and they take screws and they screw them and bang them into their floor below your feet, and they do not waver and they don't sway. Kisomer mikshohema below yidaberu, right? They fasten it with a hammer and the nails, and they're like a sculpted palm tree, right? They can't speak to you. They have no power of their own. Right? They have to be brought into the home. They can't walk themselves. That gets back to the Lord of the Rings, where the trees walked across and saved the Middle Earth. Don't fear those trees. They can't do any good to you. They can't do any bad to you. There's nothing in them. So this and other references, there are other hints in the Bible, but certainly much greater references in first and second century CE of a pagan ritual involving just this. And the time that they would put the tree in the ground like this was just around the time of the shortest day of the year. In fact, if you're following the Daf Yomi, I think it's 6, 7, 8. Yesterday's Daf Yomi, Daf Ches in the Seches of Zara, talks about two ancient festivals. One was called Saturnalia, and one was called Calandria. And they were both at the end of December, the beginning of January. And they celebrated the fact that the shortest day of the year is now behind us. Right? From the first day of summer to the first day of winter, the days are getting shorter. And according to the opinion that Adam and Eve were created in the fall, right, around Rosh Hashanah time, when he sinned and fell from God's graces, he saw that the days are getting shorter, 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 shorter. Yeah, it's going to just disappear and it's going to be all dark. So he thought that the days would continue to get shorter.
I feel that way every year.
Okay. So what makes that happen is because the earth spins on an axis. So the length of the day is a function not only of how close we are to... By the way, right this week, the earth is closest that it ever gets to the sun. The beginning of beginning to the middle of January.
Doesn't feel it because
the north of the earth is turned away from the sun because we spin on an axis. If you see a globe, we're not like this, because then we'd have eternal spring. The weather would always be the same all year, right? No, you wouldn't like it all the time. So it's this way. It's a mix. You have long days, you have short days. So when Adam saw that, he was very perceptive. It took him 3 days to realize that the days are starting to get longer, and the next day he made this festival. And he brought in trees in order to show. See, the trees are dying. No leaves. No, the trees are. I'm going to bring in a tree, and it's going
take it to my house. You can't tell in 3 days. It just changes like seconds.
Well, he's Adam and Chava, you know. He's Adam, you know, he's very perceptive of this. And so it's December 25th, the holiday involving the return of the graces of what was lost, and the tree is the representation of that, because the tree dies before us, it loses its leaves, and then it's coming back and rejuvenated. What a power! Now we all have that power, of course, we plant something in the ground, and it decomposes in the ground, and then it somehow after decomposing becomes itself again, right? So that happens to human beings too, right? But it's happening to it's happening first to the trees, and that is the sign. So that's what Yirmiyahu's example for the Jews going into exile, is that just as you were a tree that now is cut down and decomposed, your tree will return as well. And that's really the crux of what I want to present before you. I want to, certainly with the time remaining, is part four. Again, part one was the Garden of Eden and Yishayahu's vineyard. Part two was Ki Adam Eitz HaSadeh, man is a tree of the field. And the din of Baal Tashchis. We are here to take care of the world. That's really where Tu B'Shvat programs are moving today. We have to take a little better care of the earth. Mm-hmm. I just want to tell you that some of you are here in this city longer than I am. My father tells me that when he came to America in 1949, and he had an aunt who lived in Queens, that when he went over the Triborough Bridge, you could not see the Manhattan skyline from the Triborough Bridge because of the smog.
Oh, because of the smog.
Right.
You could not see what?
You couldn't see the Manhattan skyline because of the smog in New York. So, and there's probably many, many cities all over Los Angeles. We're doing better. We're working. We're doing better. Right? We're still a free society, so a lot of this is forced upon us by government regulations, but still we're doing a lot better. The Hudson is a lot cleaner than it was 40 years ago, and the world is a lot better. And a lot of it has to do with clean fuel, because 200 years ago people were dying of all kinds of cancers without even knowing it, because they were heating their homes with coal and fertilizer and other very poisonous things in their homes, and they just died at 46 without knowing what's going on. So this is crucial. If you want, you feel cold here now, right? So you want to feel warmer when it's cold. Either everyone, let's get up and move to Florida, or put on a sweater. But Tu B'Shvat, the message of Tu B'Shvat is that we are the trees. The way we treat trees is what's going to happen to us. Right, so now that my presentation will end with four different prophets. Some I'll have multiple messages, but four different prophets. They are Yirmiyahu, Zechariah, Yeshayahu, and Yechezkel. Yirmiyahu, Zechariah, Yeshayahu, Yechezkel. I should go in order, I guess. But that all four of these prophets very openly, famously, they're all very famous prophecies. They all have Torahs. Three of them are Haftorahs. The Yirmiyahu Psukim are not. But these four prophets have all framed our redemption, and even the redemptive figure around the tree. Let's look at it. Page 972. Start with that. 972 is the most famous one, the most famous example. It's the Haftorah of the eighth day of Pesach outside of Israel. Why do I say outside of Israel? Because in Israel there is no eighth day of Pesach. Right? But if 972. But if you live in very Zionistic circles, right, you may get to read this as a Haftorah. You know where they read this Haftorah sometimes in some places in Israel? On Yom HaTzmaut. I say Zionistic circles because there's no special Torah reading for Yom HaTzmaut, but there are some places if they read the Torah, they'll read the Haftorah too. the Torah reading, were you ever in a shul in Israel where they learned the special? I mean, obviously, if Yom HaTzimut falls on the Monday and Thursday, you can read the Torah parsha of the week. But if it falls on any other day of the week, and I think that Israeli government has set it up that Yom HaTzimut can only fall on like a few days of the week, right?
Really?
Yeah. In fact, I think it's hardly ever observed on the 5th of Iyar anymore. Because they don't want Yom HaTzimut or Yom HaZikaron to interfere with Shabbos. Not before and not after. So that only leaves you like Tuesday, Wednesday, right? And they only have like two or three possible days for Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaTzimut together. Right? So, in some Zionistic circles, they'll read the Parsha of Yom Simchaschem Uvimoadechem and Parshas Baaloscha on Yom HaTzimut, and then they'll take out a Haftarah and they'll read this Haftarah. And it starts like this. See, it says Haftarah 8th day of Pesach. So I'm just going to start from V'yotza Choter Migeza Yishai V'netzer Mishorashav Yifre. Right? Choter is like a wooden staff, right? Shall emerge from the Geza. A Geza is the place where the tree starts, the trunk. Right? Yishai is David's father. V'netzer misharashav Yifre. Right? Netzer is like a shoot, something just starting, it's not developed yet. Misharashav, from the roots, shall grow and prosper. Right? So Mashiach is just one pasuk. Mashiach, which is a description of it, and you get a description of the messianic age. Mashiach is a tree. Because the growth of a tree is not something anyone can ever experience and watch. It's not going to grow in front of your eyes. Right? But a tree can grow. I mean, I visited my daughter when it was last time I saw it was summer, and then we came just back now in January. They planted a small tree in her backyard. It was filled with lemons. And I just came. Big lemons. I didn't even think they were lemons because they were so big. I thought they were grapefruits. Right? And none of that would have grown right in front of your eyes, of course, but over time, it's 4 or 6 months. It's amazing what happens. Right? So that means that the messianic age is not going to just tomorrow. Okay, here it is. Basically, it's just going to fly around from the ground and okay, now we're ready to go. It's a process. Kima is the Yerushalmi calls it. Okay? Okay, that's one. Now look at two. Look at Yirmiyahu. Now this is two places in Yirmiyahu. I'm just going to do chapter 23. Yirmiyahu chapter 23. 11:22. It's verse 5. Hinei amim ba'imnu Hashem. You can have it. Page 11:22, verse 5. 11:23 if you're in the English. Days are coming, says the Lord. David tzemach tzedik. Malach melech v'iskil v'asa mishpat u'tzedakah v'aretz. He is going to be a sprout, a righteous sprout. It's going to grow from the ground. Tzemach tzedik. Have you heard of there's a group of Jews that name all their kids Tzemach, but now there's a more popular name, Menachem. It's Lubavitch. Tzemach was for some time the most popular Lubavitch name before Menachem came. And they love to point out that Tzemach and Menachem have the same gematria. That's why when we daven, we say, Es Tzemach David Avducha Miras Atzmiach, because the messianic arrival is a Tzemach. It's a growth. It's a slow growth. Painstakingly slow.
Tzemach Atzmiach, that's interesting.
And that's why we say, Bereichet Medinat Yisrael Reishis Tzmichas Yehulatena.
It's not Tzmichas, so they have to play with it. Reishis Tzmichas, so that they don't have trouble from the Haredim.
Right, because you can't call it Yehulatena, you can't call it Reishis Yehulatena, you can't call it Tzmichas Yehulatena. Reishis Tzmichas. How many more caveats do I have to give you? More than that, recently we had a rabbinic gathering. It was some kind of anniversary of Yerushalayim. We had a big tekkes here. The chief rabbi came. It was some years ago. And so I gave out different readings to different rabbanim in the neighborhood. So one of the rabbis, I think it's just chutzpah. Ask me before you do this. He was given to read the bracha for the Medina. So what does he read? Avinu shebashamayim, tzur Yisrael v'goalo, barechet medinat Yisrael, shetehei reishit tzichat yulatenu. You get it? He has one word, because obviously he doesn't think it is a reishit smichat yulatenu, because he's praying it for it to become a reishit smichat yulatenu.
Israel.
Yeah, right. Whenever, if I get an envelope of Israel, right in the garbage. When you get an envelope addressed to E Israel, it means they don't believe that there's a place on planet Earth called Israel.
No Israel.
E means Eretz Israel. But they don't want to write it out, because then they're afraid that people will get wind. But they can't. There's such lahachas. They can't even write on an envelope the name Israel.
I guess that's
E Israel is Eretz Israel. They believe it. There's a place called Eretz Israel.
Who sends it?
I mean, people who feel that way. I mean, you know, I don't think it's too many people, but right.
They're still fighting Ben Yehuda. They don't know where Kibbutz Chuga is. They don't. It's a threat to them, so they fight the old fights against Ben Gurion.
I heard this story that, you know, they're still like defacing his tombstone. Because he said that Hebrew is a flowering language of our aspirations.
That's enough right there.
Right. So, recently, this is a true story. Recently, what do you want to call them? Some Jews defaced his tombstone with some graffiti, because they wanted to speak. They wanted to keep Yiddish as the lingua franca of the Jews. Just to full disclosure, we're having a Yiddish program this Sunday night that you may want to. Saturday night. So we're showing one full feature Yiddish film called Kies Kaf, The Vow, which my father tells me about all the time. He loves Yiddish films. And another one is a 10-minute short. It's a film made in 1931 in Poland of three rabbanim. It's a funny theme, trying out for a Rosh Hashanah position in the shul. And it shows chazonim, and it shows three very different styles of what they're trying to bring to the American stage, so to say.
Oh, it's America.
I think that one's made in America. The other one's made in Poland in 1937.
Yosula would approve.
Yeah, maybe we'll see. So if you want to come back, but these people felt that Yiddish should remain the language of the Jews, and if we start speaking Hebrew, we'll assimilate, right? So the graffiti was written on his tombstone in Hebrew. So his granddaughter, or great granddaughter, Elias Ben Yehuda, who wrote the dictionary and tried to make new words for Hebrew to make it a living language. So his great granddaughter said, "See, great grandzady, you won. They're defacing your tombstone in Hebrew." And they don't know how to write in Yiddish, you know. Okay, so here it's called a Tzemach. And then in chapter 33, again, refers to this messianic figure as a Tzemach. And then I'll just take you to one more. The other prophecy of Zechariah we actually did on Chanukah. But the Yechezkel one, turn to page 1290. 1296. Pasuk 15. It says, Aftaras Vayigash. Now, in Vayigash, Yehuda challenges Yosef that he shouldn't take Binyamin and let us take him home to his father. So in Aftarah, he says, Vayidvar Hashem alei lemor, Beta ben Adam, Kach lecha eitzechad, Uchsov alav Yehuda, Udivnei Yisrael chavirav, Lekach eitzechad, Uchsov alav Yosef, Eitzephraim. Take two trees. One is for Yosef, one is for Yehuda. Because there are two Mashiachs. Right? It's funny, Christians believe in the second coming. We also believe in the second coming because there are two Mashiachs. Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Because there were two kingdoms. Mashiach is a king. So there are two kingdoms. There will be two Mashiachs. Mashiach ben Yosef prepares the way for Mashiach ben David. And those are these two trees in Yechezkel. Now, which I remember another prophet that speaks of two trees that will bring about the Messianic age. We did it Hanukkah time. Zechariah. Yes. The end of the Haftarah of Hanukkah talks about two trees leading multiple hundreds of tubes into the two sides of a menorah. And Zechariah is looking at this spectacle and says, God, what is this? What does it even mean? And God says, you have to wait for it to happen. Just tell the Jews that there is an everlasting flow of oil into the menorah. Which is the Hanukkah story. We didn't run out, that we, you know, some miraculous intervention, we didn't run out of oil for the menorah. And it had to last dafka 8 days, because they were all ritually impure through death defilement because of all the Greek persecution, and they needed 7 days to become ritually pure, right? And then they could go across the street to what's called Mount of Olives, right, and squeeze new oil. Just in time. Right? It lasted just as long as they needed it to. There are other opinions that say that the Greeks just cut down all those olive trees, but there are olive trees all over Jerusalem, you know. Just squeeze new olives. The answer is you couldn't until full seven days passed for the eighth day. You can now squeeze in ritual purity.
So if they're all cut down, how would you get oil and...
No, so even if they cut down, there's a mountain right outside the temple called Mount of Olives, because there are thousands of olive trees there, right? Mm-hmm. So were those trees there at the time, some would say that they cut them all down, but okay.
But how do we have all Tuma? Isn't Batul Barov with everybody?
No, but you could say, not Batul Barov, but you could say Tuma Hutra B'tzibur, yes. Then Pnei Yeshua asks you Kasha. And he just answers that when it comes to Chanukah Samizbeah Chinuch, when it comes to starting something new, don't cut corners. Just do it the way it's supposed to be. If they had relied on that like temporary, that dispensation of Tumah Hudra V'Tzibur, which means that in a public, you know, in the foreground of the temple, the fullness of the temple, yeah, we don't have to worry about dispensation. We didn't want to deal with dispensation.
And how were we? What, because of Tumas Mace?
It was Tumas Mace, which lasts 7 days.
No, but how did we get that through the Greeks? What was the deal?
Oh, well, they didn't. The temple was defiled. We didn't have. You need the ashes of the Paraduma and the water and sprinkle and make some people tar.
But it wasn't through Tumas Mace of a dead Jew, right?
Yeah. When you don't have a working temple, everybody gets Tumas Mace.
Because you can't. The Paraduma doesn't work. Which really didn't work in the second temple anyway. There was no Aish coming down.
You didn't need that to make the Paraduma, but okay. Okay, so you see with all these prophets, Yirmiyahu, Zechariah, Yeshayahu, Yechezkel, they're all referring to the Messianic arrival as a tzmicha, as a shoot of a tree, because it comes slowly, slowly. And Tu B'Shvat is the time of year where we finally begin, and you can start to see that It's true. It's not a solar date. It's a lunar date. Gemara asks this: why is something dependent on weather? Mm-hmm. Tu B'Shvat surely is. If it's Chag HaIlanot, right? Why is it a lunar date? It should be a solar date every year. So Gemara just says, okay, it fluctuates. Tu B'Shvat can be a full month apart in some years, right?
So
I'm saying Tu B'Shvat this coming year.
Huh?
Yeah, Shkedi is already ready
whenever,
to.
Whenever
you take the answer was it
the
weather fluctuates? Is that what you mean?
Well, the weather fluctuates. Could be in the middle of February. Could be in the middle of January.
Right, that calendar. But yeah. Why? What's the answer for that? Because
we just go after the majority of the years. You can the almonds grow first in Israel. You can already smell. If you take the taxi from the airport to Yerushalayim, you can smell the almond trees as you're passing Latrun and Shalvim. A lot of our almond groves there. You can smell them. It smells like if you have an almond tea and you smell the tea bag. That's what, you can smell that in the air. And that's why the word for almond in Hebrew,
shaked,
means lishkod, means to do something quickly. Makel shaked ani ro'eh. Tafta l'roki shaked ani on the rila soto. That's what we're here to do this time. The Mishnah says that Tu Bishvat is Chag Rosh Hashanah La'ilan. It doesn't say La'ilanot. In the song it's Chag La'ilanot, but in the Mishnah it's Chag La'ilan. It's the birthday for the tree. Not the trees, it says the tree. So there's a drash that says that there's a special prayer to say on Tu Bishvat to beg God to this coming year give us a successful etrog crop. And now if you're heavily invested in oranges, you probably want to pray for a good orange crop too. But orange futures or something. But we're all invested in a good etrog crop.
But is that Ilan a shaked?
No, the Ilan is the etrog. That's a famous B'nai Yisrael.
Yeah, it says also Ha'ilan. It's
it's pre or separate? Yes. That's a different direction I would take. If it was is that the thing that's so special about the esrog is not the fruit; it's the tree. Ki tov ha'etz l'ma'achol, said Chava. She was not inspired by the fruit, but by the tree. Ki tov ha'etz l'ma'achol, and that's what does the Torah call an esrog? A pre-etz hadar. There's two ways to understand that. It could be a pre. Eitz Hadar, it's a fruit of a beautiful tree. Or it could be a pre-eitz Hadar, a beautiful fruit tree. I'm sorry, beautiful fruit of a tree. It's a beautiful, right? A fruit of a beautiful tree, or a beautiful fruit of a tree.
They were all supposed to be like that.
In Hebrew, you can have both.
Supposed to taste
the right, fruit. Exactly. And so the esrog is the only fruit that went along.
That survived.
Yeah. So according to this, but the trup, the tamim in Parashat Emor is the fruit of a beautiful tree. Pre, comma, Eitz Hadar.
Wait, so the bark or the wood?
Yeah, they say that because Nesrog tastes. And Nesrog is the bitterest fruit on the planet.
And the tree has.
It's inedible. No, they can't do anything with it. Plus, there's a tiny bit of citrus in an esrog. It's mostly thick rind. And so you can tell an esrog from a lemon. A lemon is a thin rind. It's mostly citrus. An esrog, open up an esrog next time and you'll see.
So it dries out.
Chocolate-covered esrog rind, yeah. And then you make esrog jam with one.
Okay.
That's good.
Is that the Priyat Sador? So the Gemara says what's beautiful about the esrog is hador. It stays on the tree. It's a hider. V'hadarta p'nei zakein. Right? It's a very, very crucial thing. And in ancient Egypt, you know, everybody, they were trying to push back age. You know, they would wax the men's faces and they would wax, you know, they would mummify. You know, you hate old age. Old age was pushed off a cliff in Egypt. Comes the Torah to say, old age is a hider. The Hadarta Pnei Zakein. What makes an esrog such a beautiful tree, a beautiful fruit? Creates Hadar. You get it? Hadar means it stays. An esrog will stay on the tree for 100 years if you don't pick it.
That's why the pitum breaks, though, is it?
No, the pitum is the end, the other end. The oakets is one of the hardest connections of any fruit to its tree.
How do they
of that size.
They don't drop.
No, a person has to pull it off.
Right. Oh, that's funny.
So is this the one from the
They Ghanaian? Won't. That's one opinion. That's the Ramban's opinion. So see, an apple will get too heavy for for its stem and it'll fall to the ground. So will an orange, so will every fruit. Dates, every fruit will fall to the ground because it gets too heavy. Like a human being, if it gets too heavy, it can't fit there anymore. It's going to come out, right? But the esrog does not. Okay. All right, so I'd like to remind you. Yes. I'd like to remind you that the next class that we have on this program is February 14th, and I need to have it at noon that day, not at 10:30, because I'm doing a 6-week series at Stern College starting next Wednesday at 10:30. So just that one I have to push off. And also, this Friday night, there's a Tu B'Shvat dinner at Shul, if anybody's interested.
On the subject of language. When